This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1182 is the last in a three-part series of programs showcasing stories written and read by Kwai Lee. Kwai Lee creates a richly detailed tapestry. She deftly captures the sights, smells, and flavors of the cultural blend unique to the Hakka Chinese community in Calcutta. Born in 1950, the youngest of nine children, Lee grew up in Chatawala Gully, a Chinese ghetto in Calcutta, India. Lee attended Chinese school until she was 14, then finished high school in English at 20. 2 years later, Lee's parents arranged their daughter's marriage to a Chinese man living in Toronto. Lee communicated with her future husband by letter for 6 months before she came to Canada to marry him as a letter bride. The marriage did not work out, and Lee left after 6 months. In 1978, Lee married her current husband, Robert. She took night courses, completed her certified general accountancy in 1988, then decided to work only part-time so that she could enroll at the University of Toronto, where she earned her BA and later her MA. Kwai Lee currently lives in Mississauga, travels extensively, and writes. Tonight's first story hilariously depicts a journey to the foothills of the Himalayas. Prayers play from the speakers, and the need to appeal to a higher authority becomes obvious. The aged bus needs more than an engine to reach its destination. We meet the narrator's brother Chip, his sick, fighting cock bird, and pink-bottomed monkeys who come to drink from the swimming pool. Let's listen now to Reunion with My Brother, written and read by Kwai Lee.
Reunion with My Brother by Kwai Lee. During the Christmas of 1993, I took my husband Robert to India to meet my relatives. I left Calcutta for Canada in 1972 and returned briefly in 1979. This was my second visit in 21 years. All my brothers and my sister lived in the Calcutta area, except for Chips, 4 years my senior. Chips taught in an exclusive boarding school in Nainital, a town in the foothills of the Himalayas. When we were young, Chips and I were close. We both enjoyed reading the same type of book and used to discuss our readings of the day in detail. Once we argued over T.E. Lawrence's Seven Pillars of Wisdom and did not speak to each other for a week. After meeting with my relatives in Calcutta, Robert and I left Calcutta for the foothills of the Himalayas. We found Chips. He lived contentedly with his wife and four children, 5,000 or 6,000 feet above the Ganga River. "We can get a good view of the sun setting over China Peak," said Chips. "Sometimes you can see the Chinese soldiers patrolling the border." He led the way across the deserted schoolyard, through the dark and echoing corridors in the main school building, and up a steep path at the back of the school. We sat on a large boulder overlooking Nainital. On the main street directly below us, a bus left the station and headed down the hill. It looked like the same bus that dropped us off at the market this morning. "How was your bus trip from New Delhi to Nainital?" Chips asked. "Fine, no trouble at all," I lied. The overnight bus was over 2 hours late when it arrived in a cloud of smoke and stopped to pick up passengers. We did not think it would start up again. A shrine with the image of Shiva decorated the dashboard. An incense burner sat in front of the Hindu god. Gallons of flowers, some of them shriveled and brown, hung from the rear view mirror. The passengers sat on small, lumpy seats. The backrests of the seats rocked as the bus traveled. The window frame by my seat was bent. Through this crack blew in the fine dust from the streets. The bus driver and his assistant sounded the horn at almost every street corner. Sometimes they shouted insults at other drivers on the road. The bus stopped at the marketplace, and several parcel-laden men got on. The bus was full, and new passengers did not appear to have tickets. Some money changed hands, and the bus resumed its journey with extra passengers. Two of them sat on the floor behind the driver, and the others set up their sleeping pallets in the aisle. The loudspeaker on the bus played a song from a popular movie with the word sexy in every sentence. Some passengers joined in the chorus of sexy, 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 sexy. The song played all night as the bus drove noisily through small towns where shrouded forms move around flickering wood fires. At daybreak, the assistant driver burned incense at Shiva's shrine, and the music from the loudspeaker changed to prayers. Prayers to the gods and goddesses in the Hindu pantheon. Robert and I saw the need for appeal to higher authority. The bus ascended the first series of hills. The winding road was narrow and steep. The road, with one lane each way, did not seem to be wide enough for the bus. The wheels on the left side were perpetually a few inches from a plunge of a few hundred feet. The aged bus needed more than an engine to reach its destination. A passenger two seats ahead of me refused to look out of the window. She hid her face in her hands and moaned. Her husband scolded her. She quieted after the first hour. It was market day in town, and the people from the surrounding area came to Nainital for shopping. Robert and I spent a long time finding transportation. Finally, we reached Sherwood College in a private car. I suspected that the owner of the car was away, and the chauffeur had converted the car into his own taxi service. Robert, Chips and I sat and watched the sun set over China Peak. The last rays of the sun reflected off the snow on the higher mountain tops. The air cooled and wood smoke rose from the valley. In the fading light and thickening smoke, the scars from landslides on the mountainside soften and merge into the darkening forest. The lights of the houses on the hillside opposite where we sat winked on. It was time to go back. "My fighting cock bird is sick," said Chips. "Every 4 hours, my bird needs to take medication. If you see someone going outside in the middle of the night, don't be alarmed. It'll be me going out to feed the cock bird." We laughed. The following morning, Robert and I met the cock bird. "This poor bird was very sick." Chip caressed a healthy-looking bird. It looked at us haughtily. "He has not retained the use of his wings. You see, cockbirds need to fight with their feet, wings, and beaks. This one cannot spread its wings." He massaged the bird in the mornings and afternoons. Chips used warm water in a chamber pot to moisten his hands for the massage. He threw the bird in the air to encourage the spreading of wings. To the south and west side of the house, the ground dropped steeply away. The outdoor latrine for the boys was on the west side, 10 feet below the house. Chip threw the bird too energetically, and the bird jumped down onto the roof of the latrine. Chip and his two sons spent the next hour coaxing the birds down from the roof. They call, they wave, they yell at each other. Then eventually, Chips threw pieces of the Christmas cake a present to him and lured the bird down from the roof. Chips spent a long time preparing meals for his beloved bird. He worked butter into a bowl of flour, added some chopped liver, milk, and crushed vitamin tablets. Every morning of the 4 days that we spent with Chips, he sat in the sun with his bird on his lap, kneading this gray mixture and talking to his bird. Robert and I helped the family to get rid of monkeys. The monkeys, with their sleek brown fur and pink bottoms, seems exotic to our Western eyes. It had not rained for the past 3 weeks, and the monkeys came to the swimming pool to drink. Chips said they were a nuisance, but did not say in what way. The children brought out some firecrackers, lit the fuses, and used a catapult to launch them at the monkeys. I think the noise scared the cockbird more than the monkeys. My sister-in-law planted tomato and cabbage seedlings in 6 rusty cans to be replanted in the vegetable garden in the spring. The cans were placed against the south-facing wall. With the first loud bang, the cockbird ran and hid behind one of the cans and refused to come out. Soon we have to leave the mountain hideout. Robert and I said goodbye to the cockbird, who would miss our cakes and pastries. I dreaded the overnight train journey back to New Delhi. We had to bus down to Kathgodam, a large town at the foot of the Himalayas. Chips and his family walked down to Nainital to see us off. When we got to the bus station, the last bus had no seating or standing room. We were told that most of the taxis were all down in Kathgodam. It was 3 or 4 hours by bus to Kathgodam. 4 young men sharing the only taxi in Nainital. They were going down to the train station. Chips talked to the driver into taking 2 more passengers. Robert and I squeezed into the back seat. The 6 passengers in a taxi shifted the luggage and ourselves around as the vehicle pulled away. I did not have time to look back. As the taxi headed down towards Kathgodam, I wonder if I would ever see Chips and his cockbird again.
That was Kwaili reading her story, Reunion with My Brother. Our second story, set in 1968, begins when a Canadian sailor visits Heaven, a bar in Sasebo, Japan, where hostesses in low-cut kimonos, miniskirts, and tiny blouses attract the attention of the U.S. 6th Fleet. When a Navy base commander recruits the Japanese-speaking Neil to teach at a seminar for would-be Japanese brides, we learn how the language barrier between the young women and their fiancés has allowed huge distortions between fantasy and the reality of being a Navy bride. Let's listen now to Navy Brides from Sasebo, our second Kwaili classic tonight.
Navy Brides from Sasebo by Kwaili. On a hot summer afternoon in 1968, Neil McMullen walked into Heaven, a bar in Sasebo, Japan. Sasebo was the home port for the U.S. 6th Fleet. Neil looked around. In the dim light, 6 hostesses greeted him. One of them wore a kimono, cut low at the front to show off her cleavage. The others wore miniskirts and tiny blouses. 2 GIs sat at a table by the bar, laughing with the hostesses. On the dance floor, bodies moved to the sounds of Yellow Submarine. 4 sailors stood at the side of the dance floor, whistling and shouting comments on the sizes and shapes of the female dancers. A sign above the bar said, 2 hostesses for 2 hours, 1 beer, only 1,200 yen, or $6. From the table on his left, A hostess said to a GI beside her, "You must be an officer. Very important." Another hostess at the table, slightly to Neil's right, was looking into a young sailor's eyes. "You are so handsome." The young sailor's chest expanded. He put his arm around the hostess and said, "Back home, the girls told me." Neil headed for the bar. He sat down on a bar stool and told the bartender in Japanese that he only wanted a beer for now, no hostesses. The bartender looked him over. "You not American?" Neil answered in Japanese, "No, I'm Canadian." The bartender brought his beer. It was a slack time in the bar, so he stayed and talked. Neil was happy to practice his Japanese with him. A GI claimed the bartender's attention. "How come you speak Japanese?" the man beside Neil asked. Neil looked over. The man seemed about 55, overweight, with a receding hairline and a crew cut. "I'm a postgraduate student in religious studies. I specialize in 16th century Japan. I find the Japanese culture very interesting and am studying the Japanese language. You must be from the Sasebo Navy Base." "My name is Dan Flynn, and I am the commander in charge of personnel at the base. We need someone who can speak Japanese and English to teach on the base. Are you interested?" Neil was interested. Dan stood up. "Let's go somewhere quieter." As they left the bar, the hostesses by the door bowed and called out, "Bye, come again." Dan and Neil went to a restaurant across from the bar that served American-style food. They sat down by the window overlooking the bar. Neil ordered steak for the two of them in Japanese. Outside, a young sailor came out of the bar with his arms around two Japanese girls. Dan gestured to the sailor with his cigarette and said, "See that fellow reeling out of the beer joint? The Navy is full of kids like him. Came from rural areas, just out of high school, and left mother and a homemade apple pie for the first time when he joined the Navy." He watched as another sailor stumbled out. "That kid finished basic training and was posted to Japan. Let's call him Joe. He met Sumiko in a bar, fell in love, wanted to marry her and take her back to meet Mom and Pop in some tiny town in Arkansas that isn't on a map." The waiter brought their steaks and they ate. Dan looked at the piece of meat on his fork. "You know, the Japanese don't know how to cook a steak. They overcook it. See, this piece is brown throughout. All the juices are gone." Neil chewed on his piece. "I'm used to Japanese style of cooking. I like it," he said. Dan waved his fork, holding the piece of meat. "Well, going back to Joe and Sumiko. When Joe applied to the Navy admin for permission to marry, we transferred him to Subic Bay in the Philippines for 3 months. When he returned to Sasebo and still wanted to marry Sumiko, we set up a 3-month seminar on the base, which all the would-be brides had to attend. 3 months are too short to learn English in a totally new culture," Neil said. "We fly a couple of Navy wives over from the States to speak to the class." Dan put his fork down and looked out of the window. Two sailors, unsteady on their feet, went into the bar. "The classes are about 3 afternoons a week. You have a free hand in the running of the class." Neil asked, "What do you want me to lecture on?" Dan lit another cigarette. "American culture, everyday stuff, the favorite food, favorite drink, job markets, the single-family home with picket fence, stuff like that. What happens if the sailor did not want to wait for 3 months to marry his Japanese sweetheart? What stops him getting married in a Shinto ceremony? If he wants to take his Japanese wife back to the States, he has to marry her in a U.S. consulate or the U.S. embassy. The embassy or consulate people will not marry any U.S. Armed Forces personnel without the commanding officer's okay. The commanding officer will not give his okay unless the Japanese bride takes a course. A Japanese ceremony means that a Japanese wife of a U.S. sailor or GI cannot go to the States. It is as simple as that. Neil wanted to know the reason for this regulation. Dan sighed. You'll find out if you take the job. How much does this job pay? 500 U.S. The first class starts the first Monday next month. Well, I'll take it. Fine. Give me your address. I'll send the papers to you next week. See me if you have problems. I'm always at the base. Next month, Neil reported for duty and met his first batch of 10 students in the administration building on the U.S. Navy base. The girls bowed. Neil bowed back. Neil found that the girls spoke little or no English. He learned that all of them came from large families in the poorer rural areas of Japan. They worked on the farms until 18, then left for Sasebo. Since they had little education, the girls either worked in the factories or in the bars adjacent to the U.S. Navy base. One of the girls, Fumiya, told Neil that when she arrived in Sasebo 6 months earlier, she had worked in a plastic furniture factory. The work was hard, she said. I took the plastic chairs and tables off the conveyor belt and put them in boxes. The tables were heavy. It was hot and crowded in the factory, and I worked from 7 in the morning until 6 at night. Then her cousin told her about the bars, about the jobs in bars. Fumiya applied and became a hostess in a bar called Geisha. I liked working in Geisha. The people were nice. Well, most of them. I got more money working 2 hours in Geisha than a whole day in a plastic factory. I sent most of the money back to my father. Neil asked her what her family thought of a coming marriage to an American. My parents don't like it, Fumiya said. But they didn't say no because Ronnie is rich. Ronnie was the American fiancé. Neil was curious. How do you know that he's rich? Fumiya covered her mouth with her hand and giggled. All Americans are rich, she said. Neil found that the girl's idea of American life was based on myths, dreams, and American movies. Like Fumiya, the girls believed that all Americans owned big cars, that all Americans drove around town, radios blaring, having fun, and that all American homes came with swimming pools, big gardens, and elegant furniture. They would be happy when they married the American sailors, just like Marilyn Monroe and Kim Novak did in the movies. Neil went to see Dan. It's unbelievable. The girls think that in America, they can have everything they want. They don't even know their husbands to be at all that well. The Americans they are marrying don't speak Japanese, and the girls don't speak much English. Dan waved Neil to a chair. Relax, son. Now you know why we have classes for the girls. Just tell them how you and your parents lived in North America. Keep telling them. Want a cup of coffee? No? Before Neil left his office, Dan said, I invited 2 ex-naval wives to speak to your class. They will be here next week and will be staying for a month before returning to San Diego. Neil met the 2 ex-naval wives, Hideko and Maki, a week later. They told him their stories. They both married and went to America in 1959. Hideko's husband, Joe, was from Wakefield, a small town in Nebraska. Hideko was miserable in Wakefield. I don't speak good English, or English like Joe's people and the neighbors speak. Hideko told Neil. Joe's folks regarded me as an outsider and didn't like to talk to me. I tried to make friends with the neighbors, but they ignored me. People laughed at me to my face. They thought I was too stupid to understand. They called me Japs as they pulled the corners of their eyes upwards. Joe's folks thought I had funny manners. I bowed to people instead of shaking hands with them. In 1960, Hideko left Joe and drifted back to San Diego, where there was a community of Japanese ex-naval wives. He found a job in a bar near the San Diego Navy base and had been working in bars since. When the Navy offered her the free trip to Japan for a month, she took it. The other ex-Navy wife, Maki, told her story. Maki and her Navy husband, Ken, lived in San Diego when he was discharged from the Navy in 1961. Maki felt out of place in America. She did not understand the jokes of Ken and his friends. She did not know how to cook a steak or hamburger. She did not have friends. 6 months after Ken's discharge, he packed up and left. Maki did not speak or read English well at that time, and she had no money, so she worked in a San Diego bar as well. "Why didn't you come back to your family in Japan?" Neil asked. "I married a foreigner. I'm a foreigner now. My parents don't want me back. My friends in Japan won't talk to me. There's nothing to come back for," Maki said. After Hideko and Maki spoke to the brides-to-be, two of the girls dropped out. They decided not to marry the sailors. Soon the seminar was over. Neil walked out of the base with the 8 Japanese girls. They were booked to be married at the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo in a month's time. He stood by the door and wished them luck in their coming marriages. They bowed and thanked him, then walked to the waiting bus, talking and laughing as they went. Neil kept his fingers crossed until the bus went around the corner of the street.
That was Kwai Lee reading her story, Navy Brides from Sasebo. That concludes Life Rattle number 1182. My name is Lori Callis. Arnie Achtman recorded Kwai Lee reading her stories. Life Rattle, created by Guy Allen and Arnie Achtman, will bring you more stories next Sunday at 9.